Well, good morning once again, and happy Sabbath, everyone. We're going to pick up where we left off in Ephesians, in the series on Ephesians. It's nice that we were able to see some pictures of the modern-day city and the ruins of Ephesus. It's one of the best-preserved cities and most excavated and available to see. I think that really Ephesus and Laodicea were the two that were the most available and that we were able to really experience in many ways. And so when we read this letter to Ephesus, hopefully we can put ourselves in these words and we can learn from these words as if they're written to us, because in a sense they are. They were written to the New Testament church at the time, the first century, and that's so the dates then would have been 50-something, and here we are in 2023. So you can imagine just taking the 20 off the front, and that's the days. It would have been 53, 56, 62. And these churches were alive then. Christ had come, and he had died, and he had been resurrected, and the message now was spreading throughout the world, and it spread to the area that we now call Turkey. And there were church areas not dissimilar to Phoenix and Denver and Albuquerque and L.A. and Seattle and Portland and Atlanta. There were these cities that had churches and congregations. And those congregations all had their personalities, as ours does. And if you visited other churches, you notice that there's a slightly different personality. And just like all of us, we have our own personalities and congregations do too. So these letters were written to them. And they were written to them specifically to teach them and to help encourage them as they were on their walk. And that term walking is used often. And you kind of understand that when you go and see the places, because we walked a lot, averaged 6,000 to 8,000 steps a day throughout the whole time. So the food was healthy, the walking was plentiful. I think all of us pretty much stayed neutral on weight. Even though we ate well, we didn't put on a lot of weight because we burned it off. As they would have then, they would have walked. And they would have walked differently than the rest of society, because the rest of society would have gone to maybe that Trajan Fountain on the walk. They wouldn't have passed it. They would have stopped and paid some homage to that. Or they would have stopped at we saw the Nike bust there, or the Nike relief. Maybe they would have acknowledged that. And they would have paid some kind of attention to the gods, where the Christians would have not. And where they were all going there for an event, to the temple or to the theater that was somehow related to emperor worship, they wouldn't have gone. And they would have gathered in their homes on the Sabbath, and they would have been perceived as very different, walking a different walk. And Paul picks up on that theme of walking in Ephesians, and seven times uses that word. In Ephesians 4:1, we remember he said, "Walk worthy of the calling with which you've been called, of the invitation that you have to become disciples of God, to become like God." And picking it up in Ephesians 5, verse 1, he says, "Therefore, as we just learned about the walk, as we just went through six areas at the latter part of Ephesians 4, of putting away lying, and let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, and let anger and wrath and bitterness," and there were six different ways that Paul described changing from one type of behavior to another. He picks up that theme again, and he says, "Therefore, keep going in your walk. Strive to imitate God himself, Jesus Christ, our older brother. Think about him and do what he did." Last week, we talked about a father and a son, and how the son walks like his father, and how sometimes those characteristics go multiple generations. Someone will look like their grandfather, or walk like their grandfather, or carry themselves, or certain mannerisms will be exhibited. And so he's picking up on this theme of walking and being imitators of God as dear children. And so when we consider the invitation that we've been given to become disciples, which is different than students, Students learn from a teacher. That's a good thing. Disciples want to become like their teacher. And so they walk with them. They do everything with them. As students, they, like, not dissimilar to the dorm situation at camp, where counselors are in the dorm with their campers. So for the whole week, they do everything together. Mr. Fogelson sold that well. He says it's a work of hard work, a week of hard work with no pay. But it's so much more rewarding than that. It's in many ways a microcosm of what we see, and it's not dissimilar to the way the first century students were taught by their teachers. They did everything together like a dorm does. They eat together. They sleep in the same area. And throughout the day, they're talking about God and his ways and his words. So be imitators and walk in love. A totally different paradigm than a self-centric way of living. It's walking in love. The word here is agape. So that totally outgoing love that is interested in the welfare of others. And he goes on to describe it further, as Christ loved us and gave himself for us. And then we talked about this last week, as an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. And they would burn the incense that were a sweet-smelling aroma. And then we get into verse 3. But these things then, as we go even further than what we read in verse 4, now we'll really get into the finer details of elements that should not be part of a Christian's life, of a disciple of Christ's life. These things are not befitting a child of God. Have you ever heard the term conduct unbecoming? Perhaps someone's tried or court-martialed for conduct unbecoming an officer. They go before a committee and a judge or a judge to assess their behaviors. And they may be charged with conduct unbefitting. This does not work. If you're going to be in this role, you cannot behave in this way, and you'll be tried and you'll be punished as a result. That's why those trials exist. Well, this is describing conduct that is unbecoming a disciple of God. There's no room for any of this in any of our lives. And if it exists, we have to get rid of it. Because Christ says, this will not be in my kingdom. These attitudes, these behaviors, these thought processes have to be eradicated from those who want to be like Christ himself. Because if you value them more than you value your relationship with Christ, then there's just no room at the table for you. It'll be like this front row. The seats go empty. I think this is because this is the spray zone. No, just kidding. So, fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness. This is where it goes from preaching to personal, right? And I've been taught, Mr. Weber told me one time, every sermon should reach out and step on everybody's toes just a little bit. And maybe this is where we can make it personal. These words that were written to a church at one time but apply to us. Fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness. Are we guilty of covetousness? What does covetousness even mean? It means looking at something and desiring something that is not yours and shouldn't be yours. That's either someone else's, but it's not yours. And it's not right to be yours. And we read in other letters that covetousness is a sin we're all guilty of far more often than we might think. We have societal issues right now. And here we are in the 21st century, 20 centuries later. We deal in many ways with the very same issues, but in different ways. And let's be honest. As society, we have a problem at looking at images and coveting them. And this is not specific to any individual, age group, or gender, because we're all guilty of it. In fact, the whole industry of advertising preys upon this desire for things. We'll show you these cool shoes, or people drinking a drink and having a great time, and you think, I want to drink that drink because I want to have that good of a time. or you name it, that the vehicle that fits the persona that you want to adopt, or the purse, or the shoes, or the clothes, or that's a little bit benign in some ways, but we get far more cancerous than that. And then there are images, sexualized images of women that men look at and they think that's desirable, that's attractive. We know the anatomy of sin. It's outlined for us in James. The first you see something, and then you start to think about it, and you start to want it, and then it progresses to sin. To see it isn't a sin, necessarily. To show it probably is in the way that they show it, because they know what they're trying to encourage, what kind of thoughts they're trying to encourage, but they're trying to solicit some kind of covetousness so that you want it, to accomplish whatever the ends are. Well, Satan is the prince of the power of the air, Ephesians 2:2. So he uses media to his purposes, and he wants to distract all of us from focusing on God and what he has given us and what we should be appreciative of to the things that we want. And it drives our behavior. And if we could get to where we're constantly wanting something, we run on what could be termed as the hedonic treadmill. These hedonistic desires or physical desires. And we run on the treadmill. And as soon as we get to one thing, it's a treadmill because you never really get to the end where you're fully satisfied. You just keep running. The carrot is like dangling right in front of your treadmill, and you're running, and you just can't get to the carrot. That's the way our minds work. And Paul is highlighting that. Don't let that be named. Don't let that be your driver. Don't be guilty of wanting someone else's image. We just read, be imitators of God and walk in love. Outgoing concern. If we look at images of a young lady, let's just say, we look at images of a young lady. What have we done? We have trained an algorithm that we looked at it. We have then created demand. We stimulate, we click on it. Now that's recorded. And now more demand exists for more images of more young ladies who are somebody's daughter, somebody's sister. And you know, when I've talked to young men about porn addiction and helped them through it, one of the first questions in session one is, who does this hurt? Society would say, nobody. That's wrong. It hurts the individual. Proverbs says, can you take coals into your lap and not be burned? No, you can't. It hurts the self. It desensitizes oneself. It changes thought processes. So much so that it can really be damaging, and one can never enjoy a regular relationship as God designed it anymore, because they're tuned now to look at images and not a person. Their brain gets retrained at a young age, and this is so available now and so sterile in a sense. And I say that word because when I was a kid, to have access to images meant you had to have the images, a magazine or something. That was full of risk. You, mom goes and cleans your room and finds that thing, you're in big trouble. I would have been in big trouble. And so you had to take it from someone because you couldn't buy it, and you had to have it somewhere. Well, Satan's taking care of that, because on every device, a couple clicks away, you can get right to it, and then you can make it disappear. And so he makes it so available, makes that choice so available, but it hurts the individual. Study it. Very damaging. Very damaging. You come to the conclusion eventually that it's not worth it. But often by then, the damage is done. Keep going. Who else does it hurt? Everyone that you're either in a relationship with or in a future relationship, in that if you're married, then it hurts your marriage relationship. If you're not married, then it scars you and affects your future relationship. Who else does it hurt? How about the life that's destroyed on the other end of that lens? Someone who's trained to say, think that her or his only value is to present themselves to a camera for someone to get some pleasure out of, someone they'll never know, but that's what they think their value is until they're no longer useful for that purpose, and then they're just discarded and never the same as a result. That third person has been the most impactful portion of the conversation toward recovery. Because there's a recognition that someone today is being destroyed. Not just yourself. You can hurt yourself and think, that's on me. But to know that you're destroying someone else's life real time right now can be a powerful driver. And then we can move towards recovery once that desire to repent and to change and to overcome exists. Lives are being ruined. These words are powerful and impactful today. These, we say it out loud now. There's a stigma associated with this. Somebody could stand up and say, in the congregation right now, and say, I have anger management issues. And as a congregation, we'd say, we already know that. But we're here to help you. But someone else could say, I have some substance abuse issues. We love you. We can work through that. Nobody's going to stand up and say, I have a sexual addiction. Because there's a stigma associated with that, like, you need to go. But we do have that as a problem, and we need to talk about it because the Bible does. The Bible talks about money, and it talks about sex, and these are important drivers for humans. And so here we are. Paul is going there. Fornication, uncleanness, covetousness. First, we have to identify what it is, recognize the harmful effects that it has on us, and then desire to move forward. And that commitment to make a phone call to me or to someone else and say, I have a problem, I need help, I want to overcome, that is an indication of courage and commitment, and it's respectable. And there are tools available to help. We saw that image of Nikeo to be an overcomer and how important it is to overcome. That's who is going to be in the kingdom with God. The fact that we sin, the fact that we fall short, that's not a surprise. What is surprising, what is a miracle is when we submit to our father and to our older brother and subordinate our desires to what they want to do in us and with us. And we strive to overcome and to change and allow the miracle of the conversion process to take place in our lives because we yield to it and we submit to it. That's a miracle. That's what God wants to do through us. Be imitators of Him. If it's conduct unbecoming, identify it, recognize it, and strive to get rid of it. Have courage and commit to it. That's what Paul's saying here. I'm just reading his words in my own words. Fornication, uncleanness, covetousness. Let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. It doesn't belong. So we're adding life to his words. These things destroy people. The Expositor's Bible Commentary says sexual immorality was tolerated in the permissive pagan society of Paul's day. It was a part of the culture, even. They would cleverly make it part of their worship. Well, that's a win for the adversary, isn't it? Come and worship and commit sins and make it part of your life. He says, that is not fitting. In John Stott's book, The Message of Ephesians, he says, this was a high and holy standard to demand, for immorality was rife in Asia. Sometimes we get confused with what Asia is. So Asia is a continent, goes all the way to Turkey. So we did have opportunity to go out in a boat in the harbor there in Istanbul. And the way the harbor is, it comes around to a point. And so if you're in the harbor, on one side, you see Asia. On the other side, you see Europe, the European continent. And Turkey and Israel a little farther down, they're kind of at the confluence of Africa coming up, Asia, and Europe. And so Actually, Turkey, we know, had those earthquakes. Those three tectonic plates come together and merge in eastern Turkey. The Asia plate, the Europe plate, and the African plate. And that's the friction along those three tectonic plates is what causes so many earthquakes, which is why a lot of these cities are in ruins, because they get shaken regularly. So this was a high and holy standard. So Asia is, we're not just talking about what we know better as Eastern Asia. This is the western part of Asia that goes into Turkey and this area of the Middle East, where emperor worship and god and goddess worship was very common. And Artemis and Diana, they were regarded as the fertility goddess. And so these practices, physical practices, were common in their temples. Another reason why they were so popular. So Paul refers to these, and those in this day would have understood this. So fornication should not be named. Verse 4. Now we go just even beyond that, and we go to even more detail. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting. So these are the things that we say, not just the things we do, but the things we say, because the things that we say represent what we think about and what we value. And so he's saying, pay careful attention to what you say. And sometimes it may seem satisfying to say something that we might think is witty or sarcastic. Even if it's a little dirty, it seems like it has a little bit more of an edge to it. Then maybe you get a little more of a snicker or a little more of a laugh, and that's somehow satisfying. Paul says, no, don't let that locker room talk be amongst you. Because the things that we say represent what we think. And if we let our words devolve to that kind of humor, then what's not happening? What's not happening is productive conversation. What you're not sharing are thoughts and ideas. You're sharing dirty banter that, okay, maybe has some value, but God says, you're being called to something way beyond that. Why not fill your mind and your thoughts with something far more productive? Remember, it was the Word himself that created everything. It was through the Word. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Our words, as we are made in God's image, have creative power. Our conversations have the ability, every word, every syllable has the ability to be creative or destructive. We know where Satan would rather have us with our words and our thoughts and our conversation. God would have us in a different place. He would have us thinking about different things, talking about different things, talking about his words and his ways, or maybe something else productive, constructive. Those words won't be there if we don't put them in there. Nutrition, physically, we know, is important. Paul said that too. He said, athletes train their bodies and train their minds, and they eat good foods, because if you don't put good food into your body, you're not going to be able to expend it. And we all know that. If we go on a bicycle ride or a run and you've had two 99-cent burgers at a fast food place, what happens after that is probably not going to be your best day. Maybe they're not 99 cents anymore. That's probably from a long time ago. So you have the number one meal deal in a lot of places. So you know that if you want to be able to perform at your best, it's necessary to eat good food. It's harder to do that. To go and buy fruits, to buy vegetables, to cut them up, and to eat it is a whole lot harder than to go get a number one meal deal. It's a lot more work to find nutritional content for our mind. Similarly, requires more effort and more work. We can turn on TV and get the number one meal deal for our thought processes. In fact, what that really does is just shut down your thought processes and let you feed on whatever garbage it is that they're presenting you. Or you curate the information that you put in your mind and into your head. You're careful to select it for its nutritional purposes. The Bible is a word that we could endlessly study. There's other commentaries, there's other application, there are other words of wisdom that we can learn from. We can grow in subject matter expertise in our fields. Whatever your field is, you can grow, you can develop, you can seek the next level. You can learn to read and think differently, to stay up to date on what's going on politically. Not to obsess over it excessively, not to subordinate it to Bible study, but to know. It says in the Bible we should watch, pay attention to what's happening. So to find a good news source and know what's going on in the world and to pay attention and to watch and to see the events that are described here prophetically starting to take shape and come together and see where past events have fulfilled major roles and the stepping stones towards the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of his government. That's important. Putting those things into your mind is important. Especially when we combine them and pair them with God's word, it says to be ready to give an answer for the hope that's in you. Well, if you're in a political discussion with coworkers and they come up with something and they say, do you see this differently? And you say, as a matter of fact, I do. And you share some of God's words and his truths, but paired with a knowledge of what's going on, because if you have no idea what they're talking about, you won't be able to weigh in on that conversation. So it's good to have an awareness. But that's different than an awareness of, you know, whatever the trending rom-com is. Something that doesn't stimulate positive thought. We have to put it in there. Proverbs says, a wise man trains his mouth to learn how to speak, to learn how to teach, to learn how to use words wisely. There's so much in Proverbs. We'll take a look at that. But there are certain things that are not fitting. Expositor's Bible commentary expounds on the Greek word here, and it says that it's filthy language, foolish talk, which is morologia. So probably the root word of moron. It's moronic talk. It's kind of thoughtless banter. And he says it's stupid chatter or silly twaddle. It can be witty repartee. We all like witty banter. That can be nice, and sometimes that's funny, but this is coarse joking. It just doesn't live up to the mark. But what should we have? As we continue in the verse, it says, but rather giving of thanks. What if rather than engage in that, we talked about something that we're thankful for, or thought about something that is important and relevant? So, giving thanks to God and others, showing appreciation, that's walking in love. It's an example of what Paul is suggesting that we do here. Verse 5 drives home the point again that there are serious consequences to dismissing these words of encouragement and exhortation. For this you know, he says. Galatians 6:7 says, don't be deceived. God is not mocked, says in Galatians 6. What a person sows, that they will also reap. The seeds that you plant are going to grow a crop, and they're going to come back. You're going to harvest that at some point. And if you planted good seeds, what you receive is going to be good. You planted seeds that yield bad fruit, you're going to eat that fruit, and it's not going to taste good. I'd say there's one more option. You plant nothing, you do nothing, you'll get nothing. Maybe weeds. This you know, no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man or woman who is an idolater. So he makes the connection here that when we covet the physical, it is idolatry. Because we have set something physical up as more valuable to us than God. So now we're breaking the first commandment. What's the first commandment? Put nothing before God. Second, idolatry. We shouldn't make images or idols. We shouldn't have something physical as a representation of something that's important to us or that has some sort of power. Yet, do we give physical things power over us when we covet them? That's what this verse is saying. That is idolatry. That covetousness is idolatry. So when we sin in this way, well, we've broken number one, we've broken number two. If we call ourselves a Christian, number three, don't use God's name in vain. If we call ourselves a Christian or a disciple of Christ, yet we behave this way, now we violated verse number three. And then we probably disobeyed our parents. We show them dishonor. There's five. Then we have, you should not kill. You should not commit adultery, fornicating, uncleanness, adultery. It goes beyond just the physical act of adultery, but also fornication and also desire, as Christ himself taught us in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. And then if you take it, you're probably going to lie about it, and it's all because you coveted it. So there's 8, 9, and 10. So you break one, you can see how one commandment breaks them all, how they're all stitched together so many ways. It's not like you can just do one thing in isolation. When you pull on the thread, the whole thing moves. They're all woven together. And that's what Paul is saying here. No fornicator, no covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of God. Feel that. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Because somebody who thought they were going to make it, thought they had done what they could, I'm not saying that we can earn it, but I'm saying we can lose it. We can't earn it. We will all fall short of the standard. That's where grace and mercy comes in. But to say we can dismiss the laws because Christ died for us is a perversion of Scripture. We're reading Paul's words right here that say nothing about that. What he does say, and he keeps going in verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words. Let no one say things that aren't true and that don't correlate with these words that are inspired by God. They would be false. They would be lies. And we don't pay attention to lies. So don't let anyone deceive you. And it says, because those words or deception that lead away from the truth, that lead away from God, that lead away from God's laws, are the philosophies of men. Colossians 2, we saw that little mound that was Colossia. Colossians 2, the letter to the Colossians that were dealing with similar issues, says in Colossians 2, verse 8, beware lest anyone cheat you or take you captive through philosophy, the love of wisdom. And their wisdom was contrary in many ways to God's law. Don't let anyone cheat you through this love of wisdom and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. Don't let that happen. Be on guard. Those empty words lead to deception, and they make God angry. For because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon sons of disobedience. Do we want to write ourselves into that part of the narrative? Do we want to be the ones that anger God? And he says, I'm sorry, that place I had set for you at the table is going to go empty. That plate will never be eaten off of at the wedding feast. We've perhaps seen the tables set up for the unknown soldier, the one that's not coming back, that will no longer dine at that table. They set it up as in a way to honor those who have given their lives so that others may live and enjoy freedom, and they're not coming back. Perhaps they died in battle. We don't know where they are, or they're prisoner of war. But they're not coming back. That is a place setting set up very specifically, and it goes empty. Satan wants our seat at the table to go empty. So let's not be deceived. Let's not allow anyone to persuade us that any of these things are innocent, that they don't hurt anyone, or that they're unavoidable frailties of human nature, as Adam Clark said. They are sins and abominations in the sight of God, and those who practice them are children of disobedience. They're not imitators of God, they're imitators of the deceiver. Christ himself would say that. You are of your father, the devil. He condemned humans to that. He said, you're walking in the ways of the adversary, not in the ways of God, in spite of the fact that they thought they were. And there will be an accounting. Therefore, verse 7, do not be partakers with them. We can read Proverbs and read this encouragement over and over again. So this is an important section for us to learn to walk with God, to imitate our elder brother, learn to walk like him, and beware of conduct unbefitting a child of God.